Padres Hot Tub is brought to you by the smoking radioactive chunks on the street that remain of this disaster of a season. We will dictate the meltdown now. Welcome to the Padres Hot Tub, everybody. Craig Elston, John Gennaro with you. We are now officially gaveled into off-season mode. It's October 4th, the first possible day that we could be in off-season mode. And here we are, the Padres eliminated a 79-win team in 2021. A club expected to win 94 games across the Vegas sports books. They pull in 79. They come up 15 short of their goal. John, this is the podcast where we try and lay it down on the record what the heck went wrong with this season.
Yeah, and there's a million things, so we'll try and get to them all. I did have a funny moment today where it reminded me of you, because a couple weeks ago you played a song of some sort on this podcast from your phone into your microphone. What song was that?
It was I Know It's Over by the Smiths.
That's right. So today I'm running, and I'm just shuffling through my music, and a song comes on, and I start listening to the lyrics, and I was already thinking about this podcast, so like I was listening to the lyrics through the filter of the Padres, and I literally had to stop running because I was laughing so hard. So I'm going to read these lyrics to you. Think about them in terms of the Padres and tell me if I'm crazy or not. As I walk through this wicked world, searching for light in the darkness of insanity, I ask myself, is all hope lost? Is there only pain and hatred and misery? Verse 2. And as I walk through on troubled times, my spirit gets so downhearted sometimes. So where are the strong? And who are the trusted? And where is the harmony, the sweet harmony? And then what was the other part? 'Cause each time I feel it slipping away just makes me want to cry. That is from Elvis Costello's What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding. And I was just like listening to it. I was like the talk of like, where's the sweet harmony? And I feel it slipping away and it makes me want to cry. And I'm like, ugh, everything reminds me of the freaking Padres right now.
What's so funny about peace, love, and understanding bullpen usage? It's been a problem for months and months. Well, here are the bare numbers, my friend, of where we wind up. 79-83. Let it sink in. Marinate in this vomit. 79-83.
What a disgusting visual.
You think that's bad? Listen to this. In his post-game press conference after game 162, Jay Stingler said, paraphrasing, when he was talking about why he wanted to keep his job, that the Padres are a lot closer to being in it than they are to the other side. Okay? Mm. And that is factually incorrect. The Padres finished 28 games out of first place this year in the National League West. They finished 27 games out of second place in the National League West. 27 games out of second place. Okay, for context, they finished 27 games ahead of last place and Arizona. So they were just as close to second place as they were to last place. And the Padres finished 4.5 games ahead of the Rockies. They finished, John, in the end, 11 games behind the Cardinals for that final wild card spot. It turned out that number was 90 this year, and it moves, and sometimes it's 87, and sometimes it's 88, and this year it was 90. You had to win 90 games to make the playoffs in the National League, and the Padres won 79. I mean, you can break it down, and There's literally only one situation in which you can break it down and say the Padres succeeded this year. I won't make you try and guess this, but the Padres went 14-6 in interleague games this year.
Of course they did.
Right. When they got to play with the American League, when they got to play with the DH that for 10 of those games, you know, that the club had basically planned itself to be and game planned itself to be, they went 14-6. But against the teams that you actually have to beat in the National League West, the Padres went 34-42, and they lost the season series to the Giants and to the Dodgers and to the Rockies, and they only went 11-8 against the Arizona Diamondbacks, an absolutely terrible team that finished with 110 losses. They went 11-8 against that team, a team that won 52 games this year. So, you know, any way you chop this up, it's really sad, and the saddest of it all, it's almost unbelievable when you look at it. The last 46 games, John, 12-34. I mean, imagine starting the year 12-34 and what that would have meant.
That would have meant, like, season over. Like, we're sellers, season over.
Season over, we're sellers. Nobody comes when the ballpark opens up. You know, June 17th, when the ballpark opens up, it opens up.
By the way, I think the Padres finished third in attendance in the NL this year.
They did. It's the other thing they really succeeded at. They drew over 2 million fans. I think they were one of five teams in the league that drew over 2 million fans this year. You know, that's great. But 12-34 in the final 46 games. It was not a team that was, oh, well, they're just not as good as we thought they were. This is a meltdown. This is something different. This is an absolute, you know, floor falling out from under you collapse for the San Diego Padres. And I guess the real mystery for probably weeks, months, and years is how a team like this could wind up 79-83.
Well, the most obvious thing when you look through all the numbers, the easy numbers to decipher, is that they, as you pointed out, they were shit against their own division. That's never good. But they were really bad on the road all year long. They were bad on the road. And I don't think there was like a single point all season long in which they even approached being a 500 baseball team on the road. They finished with a winning percentage of 420, 34-47 on the road. I mean, they weren't a great home team, but they were a good home team. But when they went on the road, they couldn't get it done. That, I mean, you've watched a lot more baseball for a lot longer than I have, not to make you sound too old, but I've always been told that the teams that are really good at home and really bad on the road are the ones that are like weak-minded. Like, they can't figure out how to find their rhythm when they're uncomfortable. And I mean, that would make some sense when you look at the 2021 Padres. But yeah, if you were trying to boil it down to like one or two things, like one, they play in a really difficult division with two really good baseball teams, but that's not going to change. And two, they were absolutely shit on the road. The second one they can possibly fix. They can become a better road team.
I think home road fluctuation happens, you know, and I don't know that there's a great way. I, you talk about becoming a mentally stronger team, just a better overall team is going to be a better road team. I think good teams are good road teams. And I think mediocre teams are usually bad road teams because mediocre teams fit that profile you described, good at home, bad on the road. And that's exactly what the Padres were. They were a mediocre team. They finished, you know, within a couple of wins of 500. That's what they were. And that's a good way to point. That's a problem they had all year. And we're about to go through a list of kind of the things that happened that built up. But even so, at the 100-game mark, the Padres were 17 games over 500. You know, so you could say through 100 games that this team looked like they were a well-functioning nuclear reactor. You know, like everything was going well and it was popping out the results that you expected to, and things were within their margins. But it turned out that there was a lot that was happening beneath the surface that was combining to get to a point where once it went bad, it was going to go so bad that it was going to put up a number that the Baltimore Orioles would be proud of, 12-34.
Yeah, they at the All-Star break, they were 53-40. We believed that the Giants would run out of gas. And we also believed that the Padres were better than a 53-40 team, and that once their schedule got easier, they would win at an even better clip than that. The Giants never slowed down, and when the Padres' schedule got easier, they fell apart, oddly enough. So we were wrong about everything we thought about the second half Padres.
Well, let's try and figure that out then. Let's kind of go back and dig through some of the things. I wrote down some stuff, John. I told you before, feel free to add to this as we go through and what strikes your fancy. But kind of putting on our lab coat and doing the Jared Harris role here in the season finale of Chernobyl and trying to show what steps led and built up to this meltdown for the San Diego Padres. And one of the things I thought about right from the start, a problem that was representing from spring training, was counting on certain pitchers to be able to contribute to the San Diego Padres this year. And I think numbers 1 and 2 on that list were Denelson Lamet and Mackenzie Gore.
Yes, no argument there. I mean, when you were talking to Will Carroll about the Padres starting rotation, like, it was just hovering around the whole conversation, and it popped up a few different times. Is like, they were expecting a lot of innings and a lot of reliability from those two guys, maybe foolishly. But, you know, I remember having conversations with you before the season started of like, hey, once, you know, Weathers and Gore get it going in the beginning or in the middle part of the season, they're going to have to find spots for them in the rotation. And none of that worked out for anybody. There was plenty of spots in the rotation for lots of guys who didn't want them.
You know, it was a mistake for A.J. Preller to believe that Denelson Lamet was going to be a worthwhile contributor to the starting rotation this year. And he did believe that. The organization, as you might remember, but we're kind of going through the postmortem, they started him late in training camp. Everything they did on purpose. Keep this in mind. They could have had Denelson Lamet start spring training like everyone else and pitch like everyone else and just see what happens. And I'm not saying that's a better or worse path. What I'm saying, though, is that the Padres chose a deliberate path with the intent of preserving him to make him effective and to make him the best version of himself. So he started spring training late. He was behind all the pitchers. When the team left, he stayed behind in Peoria. Minor leagues didn't start to May, so he had no one to compete against. So he was pitching simulated games on backfields in Peoria. And remember, we kept getting these, oh, yeah, he went 5 innings and he allowed 1 hit and this and that in pretend baseball games.
Right.
You know, against, you
against
know,
children.
Yeah, exactly. Against like 15-year-olds and stuff. And then they get him up to the big leagues. And once they got him to the big leagues, he was in saran wrap every single time. Oh, well, he's up to 50 pitches. We got to take him out. Okay, well, he's up to, oh, well, he's gone 3 innings. We got to get him out of there. And so every time Lamet actually featured in a game this year, it was an absolute guarantee that at least 4 innings had to be covered by the bullpen. And quite often it was 6 or 7 innings that had to be covered by the bullpen every time that Denelson Lamet pitched. And of course, by the end of the year, he still got hurt, you know, 2 different times. Each time they did the baby back buildup. And the last time it was, okay, now you're going to be a reliever. And we're like, oh, well, he'd be an impact reliever. Oh, he could be. No, he was horrible. He was a really mediocre, unreliable reliever with no command at all, who only hurt the team when he came into games, with the exception of his very first outing. And that's your season from a guy that they absolutely counted on to be a critical producer for the team this year.
And the thing about Denelson Lamet, like a thing that I've always just seen, not that I'm a scout or anything, is that that's a guy who needs to get into a rhythm, like needs to get into a rhythm. Like the more he pitches, the more he has that feel for that slider, the better the pitcher he becomes. So that's why, like, I don't think relief work was really going to work out well for him. And he never, I mean, the whole season long, he never really found any sort of rhythm. Whereas last year was like every start was just building on one on top of the other, on top of the other. He's getting more confidence, more, he's got a better idea where that slider's going and all that stuff. So they need to get him back to a place where every fifth day he can throw and build upon what he did, you know, 5 days ago. And I don't know that they're going to get him there without surgery.
I don't know that he'll be on the team, and I quite suspect that he won't next year. But that's for later in the show. One of the hugest problems, John, that the Padres have as an organization is the gap between what we've been promised from the farm system in terms of the acumen of A.J. Preller, the talent that he gathers, and their ability to contribute, and then the actual contribution of the minor leagues to the San Diego Padres. Now, you could say, and we did say, and it's still valid, that trading prospects to get established big league players is still a way to gain value from your farm system. And clearly that's the path A.J. Preller has used the most. But because he used it so much in 2020, and that's really where this all starts, right? It all starts with 35 games into a 60-game season. The Padres draining their minor leagues of about 15 to 18 different players to go get a flurry of acquisitions to try and win the 60-game season. And it, I mean, they took 2 out of 3 from the Cardinals, so I guess you have that going for you, a team that wouldn't have been in the playoffs if it was a regular year. You know, you got to play in this expanded playoff. But for all that, you didn't have a whole bunch of ready options. So the options you had needed to be on point. And the guy that's the number one poster boy for this is Mackenzie Gore, who pitches exactly 0 innings in the major leagues this year and contributes absolutely nothing for a team that ran out of pitchers.
Yeah, and a team that, I mean, it seemed pretty obvious. They were, in the beginning of the season, planning on him eventually throwing a lot of innings for the major league team. I mean, how many podcasts did we talk about the math? How many Bandwagon Beach posts did I do about the math of, like, they're going to run out of innings unless Gore comes up and throws, like, 100, and Weathers throws 100, and they're still probably going to come up a little bit short. And what happened? Like, none of them got anywhere near that.
Absolutely. So Gore, you know, right, goes backwards, winds up pitching in instructional league, winds up disappearing for 2 months, like they were giving him an extreme makeover.
I want to say something, because I was talking to a coworker of mine the other day, and he was asking about, like, how the Padres' season had gone so sideways, and he's a Giants fan, so he was telling me how, like, before this season, he had these big long-term fears about the Padres and how good the Padres were going to get, and how, like, the Giants now were going to be chasing the Dodgers and the Padres. And so he's like, I don't understand what went wrong, like, this. Like, he knows his baseball, so, like, he does actually know what's going wrong. He said a word that is 100% accurate that I've yet to see a single Padres fan or media member covering the Padres use. And I think it's one of those, like, dirty words, like you say in a clubhouse, people will be like, whoa, what are you doing? Don't say that word. But Mackenzie Gore got the yips.
Yeah.
And, like, the yips don't really go away. Like, Rick Ankiel became an outfielder because of the yips. Steve Sachs's career, Chuck Knobloch's career was ruined by the yips. Like, the yips don't go away, which I think is why everyone has hesitated to call it the yips. But, like, that's 100% what happened to Mackenzie Gore this year. He got the freaking yips.
in some way, it wasn't to the Rick Ankiel level of he was throwing five wild pitches in an inning.
No, sure, of course, of course.
Austin Adams got the yips. Austin Adams set the MLB record for hit batsmen in 45 innings. He got the yips. You know, Mackenzie Gore had an unworkable, and this is where you get back to the deeper questions about development. Mackenzie Gore was allowed to get all the way to AAA with a windup that wasn't going to get him to the big leagues.
Apparently.
Absolutely, because look what happened, right? With that windup, he wound up regressing all the way back to rookie ball. And then they had to take it away, rebuild it, and it was a completely different delivery that Gore was using when he started to move right back up the system. And I do think there's a great chance that Mackenzie Gore, I think there's 100% chance Mackenzie Gore makes his major league debut next year, as long as he doesn't get injured between here and there. So,
yeah,
you know, he's coming now, but the year that they needed him was this year. And the Padres have, and I think Lamet and Gore, it's important why they're in the same line in this analysis, that they're two sides of a coin of how the Padres think they understand how to handle pitchers to keep them safe and effective. And in fact, they're neither keeping them safe nor effective.
Correct. Correct. And, you know, some of this, I mean, at least when it comes to Lamet, like you could possibly maybe throw at the feet of Larry Rothschild, like some of it. But yeah, at the end of the day, they did a poor job all year long of keeping their pitchers pitching to their talent and performance, and also keeping them healthy. Speaking of which, before you jump ahead to the next one, I'm going to say something because I don't see it on your list of where it went wrong.
This is what I want you to add.
There was probably around the time of the All-Star break, there was a time in which the Padres were good, but had not yet really hit their potential. But they weren't bad. And really what was keeping them afloat was a bullpen that was willing to fight.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Musgrove, who was pitching good enough. And Yu Darvish, who for a while there was pitching like an ace.
Yep.
And then Darvish's season imploded to the point where the sticky and the injuries. Like, he lost the sticky. He became slightly less effective. Then he started having hip and back injuries. Which I heard someone somewhere, and I don't know where, say that like Darvish actually has like a degenerative like hip issue that's like only going to get worse. And I haven't heard anyone say it since, so I don't know if it's a real thing or not. And I haven't been able to like, I haven't really tried, but I haven't looked it up. But there was a point in which I felt like the Padres are treading water. They're keeping their head above water. And Darvish is really the one that's allowing them to do that.
Right.
And then when his body gave out on him and the sticky went away, he sunk like a stone, ended up probably having the worst season of his career. I haven't looked it up, but I'm willing to bet it's probably the worst season of his whole career, numbers-wise, performance-wise. And he became a liability for the second half of the season. Like, you kind of knew he was either not going to be there or probably going to get bombed, like, every time his name, his number was called in the second half of the season. Like, that's big. But, I mean, even before Paddock got hurt and you basically got to, like, oh, there's one starter we can count on, and it's Joe Musgrove. Like, even before that, it was like there's two and a half starters you can count on. And Darvish was pulling more than his weight until he wasn't. And I feel like that's... Darvish falling apart was a big part of this thing going sideways.
Well, that's going to... I'll just move cut one of these little pieces around here on our little board, because if you're going to bring up the number one starter, then I think it's important to follow that by bringing up the number two starter. The Padres, after spending a teenage number of prospects at the trade deadline in 2020 to try and make a mad dash to win a 60-game title and coming up woefully short, getting swept by the team that would go on to win the championship in L.A. Of course, A.J. Preller recognized he did not have enough pitching. recognized that the two starters that were his 1-2 on his 2020 team would probably not be available for 2021. And he was right. Clevinger and Lamet, neither one would be useful for the team. And so he then traded another group of about the same size of prospects out to get Yu Darvish, Joe Musgrove, and Blake Snell. And that was supposed to be the solid 1-2-3, each of whom would throw between 180 and 200 innings this year in order to set the foundation, the formula, right, for the Padres to be able to play a 162-game season and have success. Now, as you just said very well, John, Yu Darvish did his part until the sticky band for sure, and then did 80% of his part until he got hurt, after which he was really not a very useful pitcher for the Padres, except for very short stints the rest of the way. Most of the other time, he was just a home run allowing mediocrity that was putting the Padres behind in baseball games. But the other guy was Blake Snell. Blake Snell, not Joe Musgrove, was supposed to be the second ace on the San Diego Padres. But for the entire first half of the season, Blake Snell couldn't go five innings. Never mind go six. Never mind go seven. Never mind get to 180 to 200 innings like the Padres were planning. Blake Snell couldn't go five innings. He would be at 45 pitches through two innings in every single game. And like 65 to 70 after the third inning. And you just said, well, where are we going to go from here? And the answer was to the bullpen. Because Jace Tingler, throughout the first half of the season, at any sign, you know, when the light went from green to blinking yellow, he was going to pull that starter out. And he was going to get Blake Snell out at 80 pitches, 85 pitches, all the time, letting Snell out of the game a little bit early. Snell did it to himself. It wasn't a Tingler-only situation. Snell was the one who was inefficient. And Snell was a big part of contributing eventually to the meltdown of this bullpen through overuse.
Yes. That being said, Snell got a lot better when Rothschild wasn't there. He got more efficient and more productive. And he started going seven innings and throwing 120 pitches before getting pulled. So I think it became easy, and maybe it is easy, to blame Rothschild for his inefficientness, his inefficiency, and to blame Tingler for the quick hook and be like, hey, maybe if they had just left Snell alone and let him do his thing and throw strikes, he would have been the better pitcher all year long. Now, Snell was the better pitcher for a little while and then got hurt. So then it gets to the question of like, well, can he throw 100 plus pitches every outing? Can he go six, seven innings per outing? We've never like really seen that except for his Cy Young season. So it's like kind of the question of like, can his body handle that kind of thing? But as for like blaming him for the actual like performances and stuff, like it is really easy to transfer a lot of that onto Rothschild, I think.
But I think you just said it. It's easy. I don't think there's any easy answers with the San Diego Padres this year. But I think we can come up with easy narratives, and one of them is to just say Blake Snell is Larry Rothschild's fault. You know, and maybe in that individual case, it's true. Maybe it's all of their fault. But also what you heard about Larry Rothschild is that he was upset with what the team was giving him. He wasn't happy with the scouting reports. He wasn't happy with the level of data that was coming down, and he didn't think that things were being translated the right way. And so he was butting heads, you know, organizationally with the group, and that was part of the reason why he was let go. So two sides to a story. At the end of the year, Blake Snell pitches 128 innings for the San Diego Padres, and yes, he's hurt at the very end of the year, but it's like, I would have thought, oh man, he must have taken a real bad injury to be at 128 innings for the year. Only Joe Musgrove gets to 181 and a third innings. And keep in mind, that offseason bullpen, we're going to empty the minor leagues. The minor leagues are going to have nothing in them But it doesn't matter because we've got Mackenzie Gore. We've got a kid who we haven't talked about yet, but we're going to talk about more, Ryan Weathers, right? We've got these two kind of young wonder kids. We've got Morahone. We've got Baez. So we've got this kind of top-end fill-in talent for the starters. And furthermore, we have traded a ton of capital to get three guys that we can just pencil in 180 to 200 innings pitched. And instead, you got 181, you got 166, and for Blake Snell, you got 128 and two-thirds innings. And that's just not enough. And it turned out not to be enough for the Padres. But now, I mentioned him. So when we look at the little things that lead to a later explosive meltdown, one of the real warning signs, John, and you and I have talked about it before, is when Adrian Morahone got hurt and was not replaced. And, you know, that's when Nabil Chrismat started what turned out to be one of the most effective seasons pitching for the Padres as kind of a fill-in guy. You had that, but you had nothing behind it. And you never had, like, okay, Morahone's out, Chrismat's up, and we're signing so-and-so to be the next guy into the pipeline in case the next bad thing happens. That never happened. There was never another line of defense for the San Diego Padres pitching staff.
Yeah, I remember after the trade deadline last year, and then we did this again after the Snell and Darvish trades, you know, Preller had become somewhat famous for trading for players that still had years of control, right? Nola has years of control. Clevinger had years of control. Darvish and Snell are under contract. Musgrove has years of control. Cronenworth has years of control. And we thought once AJ Preller got all those guys on the Padres, I mean, how many times did we say the window is open and it's open for 3 years because all of these guys are going to be here for the next 3 years. And I imagine Preller probably thought some of that too. Like, hey, window's open for 3 years. I got every guy I need to make this happen. And this is where it gets into the roster construction of, like, AJ Preller built a hell of a 26-man roster and didn't really account for injuries beyond, like, we're going to have some really good bench guys in Caratini, Profar, Kim, that will come in and they'll fill the gaps. And there was no thought to, like, well, we need to make sure that the minor leagues can support depth throughout the year. Because he was just like, no. Like, we have the players we need. We have the depth we need. And I think that was a miscalculation on his part.
I want to just keep with pitching before we even get to the offense, because I think we're really detailing this part of the meltdown and we got to get through the kinetic chain. All of these things that we've talked about, Denelson, let's go back up and line them up. Denelson Lamet being completely ineffective, winds up throwing, I think, 47 innings. Mackenzie Gore throwing 0 innings when he was expected to throw 80 to 100 this year in the major leagues. He contributes 0. Blake Snell comes up about 50 to 75 innings short of where the Padres expected him to be. Yu Darvish comes up 35 innings short, certainly, of where the Padres expected him to be. They expected him. He would have been the number one bet to get to 200 innings for the Padres this year. And when he starts to break down physically at the end of the year, he becomes a very ineffective pitcher. The number one guys that are there as elite backup options, Adrian Morahone and Michelle Baez. Baez pitches no innings for the Padres this year. And let's see if I can get my window back working here. How many did Morahone throw? I mean, not a lot.
Wasn't it like two?
4 2/3. 2 games, 4 2/3.
Got it.
So he throws 4 2/3 innings. Every single one of these levers being pushed in this direction impacts the pressure in the bullpen chamber. And the bullpen chamber pressure is rising. And the bullpen handled it for a very long time. They really did. They handled it for a very long time. in April and March, the Padres bullpen had an opponent's OPS plus of 93. In May, when they were leaned on as heavily as any month all season, the Padres delivered an OPS opponent OPS plus of 56. I mean, absolutely dominant. Absolutely dominant. Going into June, that's what the Padres had. And in June, you know, it was a regression, but it continued. 98 OPS plus, a lot closer to normal. That's when you started to see some trickles, but generally still, they've been better than average with a dominant stretch over 3 months. You get to the second half of the year, John, 104 OPS plus in July, 107 in August, 118 in September and October, turning their opponents into all-stars in September and October. The San Diego Padres bullpen, the pressure rose, and it rose, and it rose, and there was never a chance for it to release. And so what happens? Instead of a release, there's an explosion. And the bullpen exploded.
Again, this is why I think like the story of the season is kind of that podcast you did with Will Carroll last week about the pitchers getting injured. Because heading into the season, we said two things. Number one, where are they going to find space in this rotation for all of these really good starting pitchers? That was the thing that we said. We were like, they have Darvish and Snell and Musgrove and Lamet and Morejon and Paddock, and then Gore and Weathers will come up, and that's seven starting pitchers. How are you going to have space for all of them? Well, it worked out poorly because all of them got injured. When we talked about the bullpen before the season, what do we say? They have four closers.
Yep.
They have four closers. And what happened?
Lanson and Pomerantz and Kella and Pagan.
Right. Right. Well, Kella got hurt early. Pomerantz got hurt early. Pagan was up and down, mostly down. And Melanson couldn't do it all by himself. And if you look at their contract situation, like, it's mostly the same bullpen next year. Like, Kella will be a free agent. Not that he was here for very long. Daniel Hudson is a free agent. I don't know if they're just going to let him walk after trading away like an actual semi-decent piece to get him. The bullpen and the starting rotation just got injured. I want to say injured more than they possibly could have expected, except this is the Padres, and they have a history of their pitchers getting injured at a high rate, and therefore they either need to fix that or prepare for it. I'd rather them fix it.
And see, that's the whole thing. It's very morning radio to go, well, what could you have possibly done, right? These guys got hurt. You were counting on them for 200 innings, and you didn't. But hang on. You were counting on a 34-year-old Yu Darvish to be as good as he was in a 60-game season over 162. Any reasonable risk analyst would say there's a good chance that doesn't happen. You were counting on Blake Snell, a guy who didn't pitch more than 5 2/3 innings in any game last year, to be a 180-inning guy. He couldn't get out of the fifth until Larry Rothschild left town. You know, you were counting on Chris Paddock to take a big step forward. Chris Paddock got injured first time we've brought him up, but he got injured multiple times, finished with an ERA of 5.07, and was basically unable to help the team from the trading deadline on. You know, with the exception of a couple of starts in between injuries down the stretch. You know, and when you've cleaned out all the backups, and then you're saying, well, all these guys are just going to be a lock to do something that they really hadn't done. Even Joe Musgrove was stepping up to a level that he hadn't done before. He just managed to do it to get to the end of the year. You know, it's not unreasonable to think that those bets are going to fail, and that in doing so, you weren't really that unlucky. You maybe made marginal bets.
They definitely made marginal bets. And the only one that paid off was Musgrove. And, like, that's, you know, how many times have we said, like, oh, AJ probably likes loud tools. He also likes to swing for the fences. And sometimes that works out, and you get a Tatis or a Cronenworth or, you know, even like a Trevor Rosenthal last year, but a lot of the times it does not work out the way that you think it will, and he doesn't leave himself a lot of room for singles and doubles.
So I think we've kind of covered what happened to the pitching staff here. You know, by the end, it's smoking ruins. You know, you've got no one left. You've got Musgrove pitching, no one else. Bullpen days, Reese Kinnear, Ryan Weathers, you know, and poor Ryan Weathers, one of those kids.
Vince Velasquez.
Right. Oh, and right. That's the level that they sunk to was that last place fantasy team. Huh. And we've Jake all Arrieta, been there.
Vince Velasquez, right. Yeah.
Whoever just got released, we'll pick him up. Your trash is my new treasure. Let's see if it works better for me than it did for you. And that's how far the Padres had fallen by the time they got to the end of the year, to where they were losing 34 of 46 games. But what about the offense, John? Because the offense of the San Diego Padres in no way should go blameless for what happened. Over the course of the season, what was expected to be one of the deepest and most impactful lineups in Major League Baseball instead turned out to be a somewhat powerless mediocrity. And I think we've also got to break down what went wrong with the Padres offensively in 2021.
Well, first and foremost, like, I'm going to start beating this drum now if I haven't already started, but Padres need more power. Like, correct. They need a lot more power. And that's like a hard thing to say on a team where Tatis hit 42 home runs and Machado hit 28 and Cronenworth hit 21, but they're just not getting any power from anyone but those three guys, really. Like, you'd expect more than 17 home runs for an actual healthy Will Myers. By the way, you know, good on him for being healthy for an entire season outside of his COVID spell. But 17 home runs, not really going to cut it. Trent Grisham with 15 home runs, I think we were expecting more than that. Eric Hosmer hitting 12 home runs as a poor fielding first baseman is an embarrassment that we will undoubtedly get to. And, you know, the catching position amounting to 9 home runs between Nola and Caratini. Let me see. Did Campisano hit any this year? He did not. So 9 home runs from the catching position. There's a lot of stuff wrong with the offense. How many times we talk about their fluctuating good approach that turns into a bad approach and how often that kills the offense. They do a lot of, I mean, just painfully, painfully stupid stuff. Like the type of stuff that'll get you thrown off a Little League team where, like, you'll get 2 outs and 2 pitches and the third batter will come out and swing at the first pitch. Like, Tony Gwynn is rolling over in his freaking grave when stuff like that happens. I'm sorry. But they and, like, again, you know, kind of like the Rothschild thing, like, you can put some of this on Damian easily, but not all of it. Some of this is just players that are just not very good and not performing. You know, I think we might still be in an era, no matter how many changes they make, where the players are a little bit freaked out by Petco Park, which is why the home team always tends to hit worse than the road team at Petco Park, at least when it comes to power. Yeah, they need help. They need help, but more than anything, they need power.
Well, I think that is in general absolutely right. The Padres, the number one thing the Padres did worse in 2021 than 2020 is hit homers. They just did not hit homers at the level they did in 2020. And in particular, you know, guys you brought
especially Grisham and Myers and Hosmer, those three in particular.
Correct. Well, I was just going to say, like, when we did our preseason podcast and we talked about variables, I remember one of the variables I had on my low end was Myers and Hosmer go back to being Myers and Hosmer. And that's what happened. Except 100%
did. Yep. Yeah.
Except we got kind of the worst version of both of those things, too. We didn't just get a bad Hosmer. We got a 12 home run bad Hosmer. We didn't just get a mediocre, exactly 100 OPS plus Will Myers, we got the version that hits the fewest homers of his career, as opposed to maybe, you know, lower average, but 25 to 30 homers, you know, and that would, they could have used him being more of a slug that bombed, given what he was doing and where he was hitting in the lineup, than what they had. And then you got to get over to Manny Machado, because as we're now getting in those postmortems, Manny Machado admitting he played with a left shoulder injury the entire season. So did Fernando Tatis. So your two superstars both played with bad shoulders this year, which impacted Tatis in terms of missing 30 games, and it impacted Manny in terms of knocking a really, really good season out of being one of those, you know, kind of Hall of Fame worthy type seasons.
Yeah. And, you know, good on the leaders for playing through those kind of injuries. Like, that's, it's a good example to be setting for guys like Grisham and Myers and even Cronenworth. Yeah, I don't really have, like, a problem with those guys hitting, playing with, you know, through their shoulder injuries. It's probably a question as to, like, why we're having so many shoulder injuries. But, yeah, I mean, my issue, and again, it kind of comes down to roster construction, is, like, you knew you weren't getting power from Profar. You knew you probably weren't getting power from Kim. You know, trading for Adam Frazier doesn't get power. Nola doesn't offer power. They need to figure out something better in terms of getting home runs, because, yeah, what made last year's offense exciting, outside of the fact that, like, the team was, had a couple of red asses and seemed to always get up when the chips were down, which they did not do this year, and I'm still very confused as to why. Yeah, they slugged the hell out of the ball last year, and that's just, it's the opposite of what we saw from them this year outside of Tatis.
It's very true. Now, you also, you brought it up. Position by position, there's certain spots that really underachieved. And I think, you know, when you look at Trent Grisham, I think you can kind of put him in the group with Machado of maybe he lost some power because of the injuries he took along the way. And because he had a really solid role for the team batting in the top third of the lineup, that when he came back, it all of a sudden was, he was bouncing all over the place. You know, he was hitting eighth, he was hitting sixth, he was hitting fifth, and it just never seemed like he got his feet back under him until maybe like the very end of the year, and that was a disappointment. Catcher was a combined 616 OPS between Caratini and Nola this year, and that's just
not enough.
It's not nearly enough. And then we come to left field and Tommy Pham, and in so many ways, Tommy Pham was just a bitter disappointment in his 2 years in San Diego. We thought we were getting this hard-nosed guy who was going to bring this driven attitude to the club, who is just one of these net positive performers and everything, does everything well. You know, he's not great at anything, but he hits for some power. He gets on base. He's a good defender. He's a good hitter. You know, he can steal a bag. Like, and instead, You just got a faded version of that. You got a guy who was a really bad defender in left field instead of being a good defender. You got a guy who, yeah, hit for a little pop, had stole a couple bases, you know, had numbers in the teens in that category, in that way. But in the second half of the year, hit 193 with a 649 OPS.
Remember the first 6 weeks of the season when people were literally calling for Tommy Pham to be released because he was so bad.
Right. Well, he had a 503 OPS through the end of April this year, you know, and then a couple of guys got, you know, Tatis had COVID, Grisham got hurt, and Tommy Pham got pushed to the leadoff spot out of necessity. And Tommy Pham clicked and he took off. And the Padres had their best run as an offense as Tommy Pham led off. And in games where he led off, Pham was a really effective player for the San Diego Padres this year. He had a 782 OPS. He had a 364 on base percentage. He walked 40 times out of the leadoff spot. He had 8 homers, stole 8 bases in 63 games out of the leadoff spot. But once those guys came back that we talked about, all Tommy Pham did the rest of the year was hit 4th, 5th, 6th, or 7th. And he had OPSs of 642, 660, or 677, 557, 552 hitting in those spots in the order. He was nothing but an ineffective player. And all they did was play him in those spots, 4 through 7, the rest of the year.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what else there is to say. Some players just can't get it to work with some teams, right? We've seen this a number of times. It's happened with the Padres before a number of times. Players come here, and for whatever reason, they can't get comfortable. They don't like the fans. They don't like the ballpark, whatever. And it just doesn't work, and they need to go to another team for a change of scenery to try and get back their mojo. Like, I think Pham's more on the tail end of his career type of thing, but I'm not going to be surprised if he goes to, like, a actual good team next year and performs a lot better than he ever did with the Padres.
One of the guys we were really counting on, John, to come back and be an effective player for the San Diego Padres was Austin Nola. You know, the Padres traded so much to get a 30-year-old Austin Nola to come onto the squad. And, you know, Nola didn't hit for any power. He hit a weak 270 this year. He drove in some runs. You know, he's a professional hitter. He'll give you a good at-bat. You can say those nice things about Austin Nola. But one thing you have to say, but very few people do when they talk about Austin Nola, is what a liability he is defensively. And in the very limited time that he was behind the plate this year, opponents stole 26 bases off Austin Nola, and he caught 4. And it really, and by the way, Caratini was no good either. He allowed 47 and was caught 10. But at least people only ran on him 57 times all year. People ran on Nola 30 times in just a handful of games. You know, he wasn't behind the plate that often. And he elicited 30 stolen base attempts. And it was really when Nola came back and Frazier joined the team that the Padres went from being a running team to a team that got run on all the time and didn't do any running. And that was one of the ways the Padres' offense broke down this year.
Yeah. I want to be complimentary of Austin Nola. Like, I like his story. I think he's a good guy. Like, we both had such high hopes for him to be a Jason Kendall type, but, you know, high average hitting catcher that could be tough behind the plate. You laid out the problems defensively and had nice things to say about him offensively. Not too nice, but nice. Here's the thing. Austin Nola finished the season with an OPS of 101. That makes him the worst hitting starter that the Padres have. Like, that's the only potential starter on this team that has a lower OPS plus is Victor Caratini. Like, that's worse than Hosmer. That's worse than Pham. That's worse than Grisham. That's worse than Myers. That's, like, a little bit better than Profar and Adam Frazier. It's not, you know, 101 is supposed to be an average hitter, and I guess maybe it is, but he is a defensive liability, and there's very little chance that when he's in the lineup, he's not the worst hitter in the lineup. In terms of overall value, a lot of that comes from his complete lack of power as a hitter. So, yeah, like, and this is the thing, like, if the Padres had a lot of power elsewhere, if, you know, if they had Luis Campusano and Luis Campusano is hitting 25 bombs a year, and they have a first baseman who's hitting 30-plus bombs a year, you can totally get by with Austin Nola as, like, your DH, should the DH return back to the NL, and please, God. But because there's no power on this team at the positions, you just, like, you can't have Austin Nola in there. He doesn't really help your team offensively. He hurts your team defensively. Like, thank God he is under team control, basically making like $500,000 a year. Again, next year, he'll make like $600,000 next year, which sounds nice to you and I, but for a baseball player, it's not that much money. And they don't have to be faced with any sort of decision yet about like, oh, is he worth the money? But he's proven a couple things. He'll kill your team if he's the catcher. If he is the catcher, he'll last about 2 weeks before his bones that are made of glass start shattering. And three, he's not offensively good enough to be anything more than like a utility player. Like in a perfect world, they probably trade Adam Frazier and skip like slide Nola into the spot of like you're our other utility infielder. Because, you know, he came up as a shortstop. We've seen him play second base. Like, if he can do those things better than he can catch, and it would seem that he can, it'd be hard for him not to be able to, then that's probably the role he should have. But I never want to see Austin Nola catch another game with the Padres. A, because he's bad at it, and two, because his body can't handle it. And like,
I love that you did A and two, which is
thank you,
which is about as good as Austin Nola handles throwing out runners.
Yeah, and he's just not offensively talented enough to be anything except the worst hitter in the lineup. And like, that's, you're never trying to get your worst hitter. Like, I know that's sad because AJ Preller gave up so much to get him, but he is the worst hitter in the lineup and probably the worst defender the Padres have. Like, we should stop calling him a starter. We should start saying like he needs to earn a roster spot next year.
And not to dip too much into the post break of what's next, but you've got a solution here on the Padres roster. The problem is, will the Padres be willing to have Luis Camposano, a rookie, handle a veteran pitching staff on a must-win season and be able to integrate his bat in to get some actual power into the position? Teams like the Tampa Bay Rays don't even think about questions like that. They do it at the drop of a hat. For the Padres, it's the combination of the pressure of player capital, meaning how much was spent for Austin Nola, and political capital.
Sunk cost.
Right, and political capital. Oh, Victor Caratini is now two of your top three starters' personal starter. And therefore, he has to be here, too. So now what are you even going to do with Luis Camposano? You've got no room for him next year.
Well, and also there was, I mean, you could kind of tell that the pitchers that had to throw to Camposano this year were not happy about it. Like, Snell and Paddock in particular were not happy about having to throw to Camposano. I think you have to hope that Camposano grows up quickly. And you also have to go to those guys and be like, look, do you want the catcher that you want to throw to, or do you want us to score some runs? Because, like, I bet you'd like to pitch with a lead. I bet you would. All right, let's go with the guy who might be able to provide us with that lead. Because Austin Nola may be a great guy to throw to, but he is, like, maybe the worst Padres player in terms of, like, I'm trying to win a baseball game to have in the lineup.
And circling back to kind of one of the first guys we talked about, it's the last bullet point I had, that top prospects to the Padres' top roster delivered nothing in 2021. Luis Camposano was extraordinarily bad in a very brief April, you know, stint before going to the minors and being there the rest of the year.
I always get a kick out of the fact that Luis Camposano played 11 games for the Padres this year, had 38 plate appearances, and since we've quoted it a few times, I don't feel bad about doing this. Do you know what his OPS plus was?
Like 30, maybe?
Negative 20.
That's even worse.
I didn't know it went into negatives, Greg.
So, in other words, if he was 20% worse than just the dirt
nothing
at home plate?
Then nothing. Correct. If he had stood there and never swung the bat, he'd be 20% better. Yeah, I didn't know negatives was a thing. It is when you get into like pitchers hitting, but yeah. Like Joe Musgrove was a better hitter than him this year. Ryan Weathers was a better hitter than him this year. Craig Stammen was a better hitter than Luis Camposano for the San Diego Padres this year. It cannot be stated enough. how bad Luis Campusano was for the San Diego Padres this year, which is outright shocking compared to how good of a hitter he actually is and will be.
When you really think about it, in 2021, the Padres' top prospects acted like a disadvantage in a game. You know, like, you must carry these four items, but they will deliver no value to you, but you cannot drop them. You know, and you're like, well, that's the disadvantage that I've been saddled with in this game because I bought this or that, you know. And that's what it, you can't use Gore. You can't. CJ Abrams, the number one prospect in the whole system, doesn't have a developmental year. He gets injured and he contributes nothing at the big league level. In spring training, we were talking like, oh, CJ Abrams by June might be on this team. You never know. He might be the best player on the entire roster.
Yeah, which, yeah. I do want to say this. I have to think, like, part of the reason Preller unloaded his minor leagues last year had something to do with the fact that they didn't have minor leagues. Like, I imagine he was trying to play some sort of game on, like, well, when they come back, everyone's like, these guys are not going to be as good. And he that kind of backfired for him. He traded away a lot of guys that look like they're going to be really good. Going into this year, he absolutely understood that his minor league system was bad. He probably didn't do enough to take care of it. But there is a prospect who actually played well for the San Diego Padres this year. You're just not thinking about him.
Who that?
It's Ha-Seong Kim.
He didn't really. First of all, he's not a prospect. He's an international free agent. We signed him
why are we not considering him a prospect? He was a rookie. He's 25 years old. Like, I know he didn't come through an American minor league system, but, like, when you look at his age compared to everyone else on the roster, like, it's pretty fucking clear this guy is a prospect. He's just a prospect they plucked out of Korea and went like, hey, let's see if we can turn this into a good Major League Baseball player, and then probably trade him away, since that's what Preller does. But Kim didn't have the greatest year, but I think you keep saying, like, they got absolutely nothing from their prospects. I would argue that they got something from Kim, and they got something from Weathers. It just wasn't always good.
And that really does it. Part of it is how you look at it. I accept that. What you got from Kim was you got defensive value. Okay. But I think really we should have Kim on the list of what went wrong for the San Diego Padres. And that's another one of the Preller mistakes, which was this planning on having a DH and creating this redundancy of middle infielders, you know, with signing Profar and Kim to go behind what you already had with Cronenworth, and then eventually, of course, trading for Frazier as well. But let's be honest. We're not going to spend all the time tonight. We'll probably do more next week on the financial situation for the San Diego Padres going forward. But they're in a corner. And part of that is because they'll spend $7 million on Ha-Seong Kim next year. To do what? We have no idea. He has no role on this team right now. And what he did do was hit at a very, very low level while playing great defense and barely playing at all. You know, overall, just barely playing at all. And I would just include him in. We got nothing out of him in terms of no one broke through and was like, well, there's the impact player that really helped the San Diego Padres.
No, of course not. Yeah, no, that didn't happen at all. I was just fighting back at the notion that they got zero. I think they got more than zero, but it's not much more. Yeah, next year, Eric Hosmer makes $21 million. Jerks and Profar makes a little over $7 million. Ha-Seong Kim makes $7 million. Jake Marisnyk makes $4 million next year. That's fantastic. And Drew Pomerantz makes $10 million. I wasn't doing the math there. So that's 14 plus 14 plus 20. 48 million. $48 million on players that either won't impact next year. Like I'm not gonna sit here and pretend that Drew Pomerantz is gonna do anything next year. Either won't impact next year or are like probably below replacement level. Like $48 million can in a year can get you a very good player. Like one very good player. It can get you two very good players.
No one makes, unless it's Trevor Bauer, no one's ever made money like that in baseball, right, right. $48
million. But, that's what, but to spend $48 million and probably get negative war as a result of it is, that would be disappointing if that happened again.
Right. And of course, all that's left to detail on what went wrong were all the things that we have detailed in agonizing detail for the last 8 weeks. And that's what happened at the deadline, the psychological impact of the rug being pulled out from under them in terms of we just got Max Scherzer and Trey Turner. Nope. Whoops. The Dodgers got them instead. The team that you thought you were good enough to beat, the team you had beaten 7 out of 10. Now they've got your Scherzer and they got Trey Turner as well. But don't worry, you'll get the consolation prize of absolutely nothing to improve a starting rotation that is now in the midst of the full meltdown that we were talking about in the first hour of this podcast.
The Dodgers are the anti-Padres, and it drives me insane in that, like literally everything that's wrong with the Padres, the Dodgers have opposite. Like, every injury they had, it's like, oh, we'll just bring in another starting pitcher from the minors who's totally ready to be a really good MLB starting pitcher. They lost Bauer and Kershaw. Like, that was basically their 1-2 pitchers.
And May.
And May. So, like, that's 1-2-5 out of their starting rotation. 60% of their starting rotation. And it just didn't matter. Their rotation got better.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a stupid amount of depth. And they also, like, they had a lot less injuries to deal with than the Padres because their training staff is better at avoiding injuries. And every player they added, like, let's compare what happened when the Dodgers got Pujols to what happened to Adam Frazier when he came to the Padres.
Right.
Like, they know how to make the most of players. They know how to keep players healthy. And they have enough depth to deal with emergency situations. And the Padres are 0-for-3 on all of them. Strikeout.
Yep, yep. And the other big thing, you know, what are the other big things that happened around the deadline? The Padres make a very, very ill-fated trade for their roster construction in Adam Frazier. They create a very difficult situation for Jace Tingler on a nightly basis in terms of he either has to bench one of his starting players or he has to play a player out of position every game the rest of the year. Because Adam Frazier is there. That trade never worked out for the San Diego Padres. He hit like just any random slappy with the San Diego Padres. The player that the all-star, you know, league hits leader, blah, 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 that we heard about with the Pittsburgh Pirates, that didn't manifest in San Diego at all. Where Adam Frazier wound up just being a 267 hitter. With a 335 slugging percentage in San Diego, 267.
Were you the one who was comparing him to? Were you the one who was comparing him to Mark Bellhorn? Because I felt like that turned out to be a good comparison.
I wasn't, but I like it. I like that a lot. And what's the last thing that happens at the deadline, John? The Padres failed to trade Eric Hosmer, but they pushed the button on saying negative Hosmer things in public. And as a result, they lose Eric Hosmer. And it's not like he's a great guy that was leading the team, but apparently he turned into full active cancer mode from the moment his name started getting floated in trade rumors until he struck out to end the Padres' miserable final game of the season.
Well, look, it was a rigged trade deadline. The fake news would have you believe that every player in every team in baseball doesn't want to trade for Eric Hosmer when they obviously do. He's our one true president and first baseman. I want you to read this Darren Smith thing that you wrote down about Hosmer, and then I have like a theory about Hosmer, because like up until Darren talked about it today, we've theorized that like Hosmer is he's a terrible leader and who could possibly like him in the clubhouse. But everything we hear from AC and Lynn is like, the players love him. They gravitate to him. The players were really upset about, you know, the team trying to trade him at the deadline, making him sound like he is actually, even if we don't acknowledge it, a team leader and whatever behind the scenes. The Darren thing was kind of a revolution and revelation, and it coincided with a theory that I had. So I want you to do the Darren thing, and then I'll tell you about my theory.
Okay, I will do that, but I want you just to notice that we have, over the course of the last 40 or so minutes, laid out for you all of the different pieces that take you from a team that looks at the 100-game mark like it's thriving, 17 games over 500, and poised to make a move through Colorado and Arizona to push for first place, and instead winds up with the smoking radioactive wreckage of 34 losses in 46 games, the whole coaching staff presumably getting blown out, and a quote-unquote leader going full cancer. We detail this all next. Hey, the Padres conversation and the community continues even when the season is over at patreon.com/PadresHotTub. That's where, John, hundreds of folks for as little as $5 a month have made the decision to jump in and be a part of a community that's just going to keep on rolling even as we head into the off season.
Yeah, I keep getting the occasional question of like, well, what are you guys going to do now that the season's over? And it's pretty easy. We're going to keep talking about the Padres when there's an opportunity to do so. Instead of doing group therapy, we're going to bring back Casual Friday, kind of talk about all the issues and topics of the day that we feel like discussing. We'll still do Have a Drink. It'll just probably expand a little, be a little slightly less focused on Padres and baseball. And hopefully we can pull off some events, because I really want to do some events and meet some of our Patreon subscribers.
Folks who subscribe at $5 a month at patreon.com/PadresHotTub get the chance to join our Discord and be a part of that community for absolutely nothing. And the community works whether or not John and I are in it. However, Discord folks also get the chance to be a participant in our Friday podcasts. And that's going to continue. We already decided going from group therapy into Casual Friday, we'll bring a guest on, but we'll be on the Discord. So an opportunity for you to exclusively listen in to a live recording as it's happening, and also put your hand up and participate and throw in your own two cents as you become a live guest on the air. It's exclusive to our Patreon subscribers. So check it out. It's the start of the month. Why not do it? It's the cost of basically one trip to Starbucks, less than that, to give us a month of your time. And just about everybody who's done it so far has decided to keep on going. So why don't you try it too? Patreon.com/PadresHotTub. Okay, John, so we're doing this. It's now late on Monday night, and I think we can officially say that Jace Tingler will see the morn for the San Diego Padres. He was not fired, at least publicly, today. And that got a lot of people nervous.
He's going to be fired.
Is it tomorrow? Is it Friday? When is it?
I don't care when it is. He's going to be fired. He has 1 year left on his contract. The team, the coaches, the players are openly talking about this guy getting fired. So, number one, bringing him back in the last year of his deal when you've already openly talked about him getting fired means that every player will literally spit in his face the second he tries to open his mouth. Number two, your other option, you can't extend him. You understand that would take this team back like 6 years in terms of reputation. You cannot extend him. It is do all the move deck chairs and bring all your friends in, AJ Preller, for all the scouting and director of whatever. Do all that. No one sees that. If you do not fire Jace Tingler, this team will be, it'll be the biggest joke that the San Diego Padres have told in 30 years. And there's been a lot of jokes in 30 years. There's no way. There's absolutely no way that they can even try and be a half-functional team with Jace Tingler as the manager next year. They wanted to let him finish the season. They'll probably give it a few days, wait for Friday, do a quick dump right before the weekend, and be like, oh, by the way, Jace Tingler's being moved to, you know, director of player development at the Fort Worth Tin Cat, or they'll just fire him. The chance of him being the manager of the San Diego Padres next year is 0%. I'm sorry, it's 0%. I will eat a hat. I don't care.
Okay, because I don't think it's zero.
It's zero. It has to be zero.
I don't think it's zero. I don't think it's going to happen. I still agree with you. I really did think they would fire him today. So I'm a little surprised by that. But and they fired Andy Green with 8 games to go in the season in 2019. Different situation, I know. But not that different. The Padres were eliminated a week ago with 8 games to play. So it could have been done that day too. But no decision yet. We'll find out. The one way you could keep Jace Tingler is by creating a public narrative that absolves Jace Tingler. Creating a public narrative that says, you know what? It's A.J. Preller's fault because he gave a guy going into his first big league full season as a manager a Rubik's Cube of a team to try and figure out as opposed to a simple puzzle. And it appears that Eric Hosmer was a puzzle piece that did not fit. I was at the El Cajon branch of the San Diego Public Library today, John, doing some fishing, as I've been doing the last few weeks to try and build out the historical catalog for the club I work for. And while I was fishing, I remembered at a little bit after 12 o'clock to tune into Darren, because I was like,
Someone's going to think that you're just saying fishing in a funny way, which I know. Just kills me.
And I'm just going to leave it without explanation and see if you guys can figure it out. And so I tuned in and I had Darren in my earphones, you know, while I was fishing. And he had some very interesting quotes about Eric Hosmer as he was explaining why he thought Jace Tingler might not get fired and how maybe they created a very difficult team to manage based on clubhouse composition and how maybe internally the Padres are recognizing that they made a difficult situation. Now, what he said, I was like, huh. And I put a note in the Discord. But then before I got here on the podcast, I went back, I listened, and I transcribed. Like, I took notes while listening, rewinding to make sure I got the words right. And this is what Darren said today on the show. Quote, some of the stuff on Hosmer about how quickly he seemingly went south in there is going to start going public. In a couple of separate conversations with people who I don't think are operating in the same ecosystem internally, meaning, you know, two kind of like different parts of the Padre organization. Back to his quote. You can sort of hear, I cannot believe Hosmer went so south on us. You can hear that. Quote, we have no chance of winning until we get rid of that. He just hates everybody. He doesn't talk to anybody. Those are all quotes from what he was being told about Eric Hosmer from two different Padres sources who are in different ecosystems within the organization.
Yeah, Eric Hosmer is a cancer. He's a cancer. He's a clubhouse cancer. And like, I don't want to say like our current times and political landscape probably played some role in it, but some of the people that are, you know, were personality flawed. I've gotten louder about their personality flaws. But this is the thing I texted you about, that my theory that I want to explore on Hosmer. Because, you know, Hosmer and Machado have always been close, right? But I saw a quote from Machado yesterday. I was a little annoyed by it, so it stuck with me. They were asking Machado, someone was asking Machado if he thought, you know, Tingler should keep his job, and I actually thought Machado did a very good job of saying no without saying no, and he did such a good job that I saw some people taking it as a defense of Jace Tingler, which is amusing to me. But one of the things that he said was, I don't get involved with front office stuff. I'm a baseball player. The team pays me to play baseball. focused on playing baseball. And it reminded me of what he was yelling at Tatis.
Right.
Right? Get your head out of your ass and go play baseball. You're here to play baseball. Go play baseball. That's what he was yelling at him, right? Go play baseball.
Yep.
And I was thinking, like, it's so transparently obvious to the point that we don't even, like, sugarcoat it anymore. It's so transparently obvious that Eric Hosmer is one of Kevin Acey's sources in the Padres clubhouse, right?
Sure.
And that's why every opportunity he has, Kevin Acey is looking to write nice things about Eric Hosmer because he's trying to protect his source. I would not be shocked, based on some of the things I've seen Dennis Lynn write, to find out that Eric Hosmer is a source for Dennis Lynn as well, and that Dennis is just not quite as giving with the praise as Kevin Acey is, because he's a more balanced reporter. That being said, like, if we can see how transparent it is between Hosmer and Acey, let's leave Dennis out of this for a second, the players definitely understand that Haas is AC's source, right? Which means, like, A, the obvious things of, like, okay, don't say anything around him that you don't want getting to AC, right? Which already starts to hurt relationships. But more to that, that's not a go play baseball mentality. That's a, like, oh, I have to be out there. I have to protect my reputation. I need this journalist in my pocket so that he can put my narrative up there. Like, I'm sure while Haas is doing all of that stuff, Machado is just looking at him like, would you just fucking put the phone down and go play baseball? Like, we get paid to play baseball, not play with the journalist. Go play baseball. And that was my theory of, like, I imagine things in the clubhouse may have been good with Hosmer. Like some of my family members, and hopefully none of yours, Craig, and none of our listeners, I imagine Hosmer's gotten a little crazy over the last couple years. Like, the Fox News brain worm has snuck in and started rotting his brain, and dictating who he's professing his love for and all of that. But I have to imagine that Hosmer is a distraction at this point. You know, obviously, like, won't get the vaccine, won't talk to the media, is trying to push out his own media narratives, and at the same time is showing, like, so many signs that he does not practice baseball. Like, his what he does at first base compared to what he used to do at first base,
oh my
can
God.
it can only be described as someone who has completely given up on practicing and working at his craft. He's completely given up on playing baseball. He literally just shows up and does the bare minimum of playing baseball so that he can cash his checks and continue to try and push this narrative through the media members that read his text messages that I'm the actual leader. You don't see me, but I'm the actual leader, and the young guys really gravitate to me, and everyone was really upset when the team tried to trade me in July and all that stuff. I think there's definitely a story or a theory here that, like, whatever influence he used to have rotted away this year, and Hosmer probably blames that on AJ Preller and leaks about, like, the team trying to shop him around, when in reality it's the fact that Hosmer is not just playing baseball, like, not focused on playing baseball.
We've covered a lot of ground. It's been a long podcast. I don't want to go all the way through the Padres financial corner that they are in. I do recommend H.J. Preller put up a really good piece on this on his blog site on Gwintelligence.com. And if you go
stop see saying it, your name.
I didn't. I mean, look, first of all, I'm talking about the good one on the show. Which was always the mistake that you made. HJ does a fine job. And this is the thing about it is, you know, he's like that good player that only plays in four golf tournaments a year, but will cash in three of them, you know, and everyone on tour is like,
I'm not even joking. That might actually be who he is. He might actually do that.
Yeah. And it's like every time they're like, oh shit, the badass showed up. You know, we know one of the cash spots is taken. HJ's here, but he only shows up four times a year. So he's not actually a threat. You know, he only shows up four times a year. It's no big deal. If he showed up every week, then we'd have to have a different. But I invite you all to go check it out. It's a good breakdown. Cliff Notes version, 100% guaranteed. The Padres are on the hook for $144.64 million of salary next year for 10 players.
And somehow, Fernando Tatis Jr., who signed a $340 million contract, is only getting paid $5 million next year.
Yeah, 5.7. Like, yeah, that's it.
This is still the window in which Tatis is, like, cheap, and you need to take advantage of it and spread the money around on the rest of your roster.
You get to 12 players at $149.6 million when you add in Craig Stammen and Pierce Johnson. And that's before Joe Musgrove goes to arbitration. That's before you deal with Frazier and Lamet. That's before you deal with Strom and Pagan and Caratini and Altavilla and Paddock and Hill, who are all arbitration eligible. If you get them all in, you're basically talking at $178 million without improving one thing on this team, without changing or improving one thing on this team. You're at $178 million. It really does make you depressed. And I want to offer, because you've brought him up a couple times, what might be our parachute. It might be our way out of here, which is the new collective bargaining agreement. It's the known unknown. We don't know what this new agreement's going to be. But one of the things that's being definitely talked about is the implementation of a salary floor for Major League Baseball that's going to force some teams to add salary in order to be avoiding a penalty. And in that circumstance, our friend Will Carroll at Injury Expert on Twitter tweeted today that he thought Eric Hosmer would be the kind of player that would actually have value after the new CBA as essentially one of those NBA expiring contract, dead contract kind of players. Like, okay, you can go slot him over to the Pirates, and in one fell swoop, the Pirates are this much closer to making the salary floor.
I mean, if there is a salary floor, that's one way to do it for sure. I don't know why Will Myers wouldn't have similar value.
He might.
He might.
And if you could back $41 million off of the payroll while simultaneously taking two completely replaceable players off of the roster.
Does anyone want Profar or Drew Pomeranz? They make money too.
No one's going to take
it. Just put a yard sale sign right in front. Overpriced players, yard sale at Petco Park. Come on by, teams that need to hit the salary floor.
Fix your floor. Come on over. We've got dead wood that you can use to put into your floor.
Right.
Well, John, is there anything else you'd like to add to our Chernobyl podcast, breaking down what turned a 94-win Vegas team into a 79-win team? Oh, I didn't mention this. I had it at the top of the notes, but let's put it at the end of the notes. Your boy, Alphonius Joseph Preller. Names possibly incorrect. Seven seasons as GM of the Padres. Here are his win totals. 74, 68, 71, 66, 70, 37, 79.
Yeah, I mean, there's progress there. They went from 74 to 79. Yeah, I mean, if you throw out the wonky 2020 that, like, again, I'll point out that that team was on its way to a collapse if they had to play more than 60 games. Yeah, that's below 500 every season.
Every season, 7 years.
Below 500 every season, yeah.
That includes, in those seven seasons, the two biggest buildups in Padres franchise history. The two biggest swing for the fence, empty the farm system moves in franchise history. And the Padres, according to Dennis Lynn, are projected to, in the ultimate level of incompetence, they are projected to just barely go over the luxury tax threshold for 2021, thus triggering the potential for penalties in 2022 that makes them less likely to spend over $180 million next year.
Thank you for that Adam Frazier trade. Really worked out great. Yeah.
While being boxed into $178 million of commitment, pretty much. Before you start the team.
I like how our hope is like, maybe baseball will change the rules in a way in which our garbage is worth something.
Yes.
Like, that's literally our view on the Padres as a whole of like, ooh, if they change the rules and we get a designated hitter, this team almost makes sense. And then the other side of it is like, well, if they change the rules to where overpriced players are the type of players that everybody wants, that'll really work out well for us. Like, I feel like I'm reading a Dr. Seuss book.
Yeah. Or again, it's like, well, we can't win these elections. What if we gerrymandered?
Yeah.
Let's change the rules that makes it look like our team is a winner instead of a loser. 27
Ron
games.
Fowler.
What's that?
Get Ron Fowler to change all the rules for us.
27 games out of second place, man. 27 games behind the LA Dodgers at the end of the year. And I mean, they earned every inch of that distance. It feels like there were 270 games behind the Dodgers at the end of the year. Incredible that this franchise wound up smoking wreckage, 34 losses in 46 games. And the one true positive, you mentioned it earlier, and I do think this is where I want to wrap up tonight. It's kind of an extension of what I said on group therapy a couple weeks ago, or last week, but everyone who's coming after San Diego Padre fans for supporting the team, just shut up, slow your roll, go sit in the corner. I saw people when the Padres finished third in attendance this year. Over 2 million people went to Padres games. And people were responding to me going, LOL, I guess San Diegans believe the hype. It's like, no, it was great to go to Padres games. Yeah. And it was a ton of fun. And it was a really good team that completely, totally, and utterly collapsed. Never take that out of the center. Never put yourself in the center of it. Oh, it was my fault because I took a picture with my buddy and we put it on the Discord at Wrigley Field and that's the day it went all down. Or, oh, it's our fault because we promoted Hee-Hee Streams and Hee-Hee Streams went dark and then the Padres fell to crap and it was all that, you know. Oh, well, it's our fault because we bought the swag chain and we brought the swag chain and then the team lost and so it's our fault. Ha ha, we're dumb fans. We should have been cynical. We should have, in the beginning of the year, said this team sucks. We should have never watched. Like, well, baseball's stupid. You should never watch. But for everybody that supported this team, be proud to be a Padres fan. Be happy you supported the team. Be thankful that the team did well in attendance. It's something to be proud of, not to be ashamed of because, ha ha, we got duped by the dummy Padres. If we could get rid of that stupid, hopeless loser mentality. That's the loser mentality that keeps us in this deadly circle of 74, 68, 71, 66 wins. It'll never work out. You know, it's the same stuff. Well, we can't get rid of the manager because manager doesn't matter anyways. I guess it's just the players are the problem. Well, can't change the players. And what are we going to do? I guess we should just stick with it. It's like, there's always a better solution. Ask better questions and don't be down on yourself because the Padres let you down. The Padres let you down. Be down on the Padres. Don't be down on them. Don't be down on us. Support Padres Hot Tub. And put it where it belongs. Put it on the Padres. This is their mess up and it's on them, painted into a corner to try and find their way out of it for next year.
Hopefully they'll get there.
Padres Hot Tub. We'll talk to you at the end of the week. We'll do that.
Of insanity, I ask myself.